finally. My name's Seth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Seth. We love you, Seth. Lots and lots and lots.
How much?
Thank y'all. It's good to be here. I love y'all too. So I guess I'm just going to kind of go through what a lot of people's already said, but it's, you know, put on my heart to thank all the people that put this weekend together. I know I've been on several host committees, not several, a couple, and I know what goes in. I'm not going to lie. I know what goes into making this weekend happen, and it's not easy, you know. And so can we get another round of applause for the host committee, please? Yeah, y'all did a great job, and I really thought this was a committee decision. I didn't know that Jordan just self-willed me in here, so I really felt bad. I really was feeling good until he just said that, so because the host committee, they did work hard all year, and now here I am, so I guess he's a trusted servant. I believe so. Thank you, Jordan, for asking me to speak. It's good. I'm glad to be here, and before I forget, I'd like to thank Bree, who spoke last night. I think we should give her another round of applause. She did a great job. And, things have really sped up for me here lately. I tell you, listen, I'm not going to mess this up. I just moved to Des Moines 2 days ago, so... So I've been here. I worked here a couple of last year or something. I've been to a lot of the meetings, so I'm trying not to mess this up. And it's by God's grace, sponsorship, and you people that I've been sober since April the 1st, 2008. And I'm real excited about that. There's a lot of people that love me that's happy about that, and I tell you, it was a long road to get here for me. It looked like for a long time that I wasn't going to be able to enjoy the opportunities that I've seen other people in Alcoholics Anonymous have, like get a job and pay taxes and, you know, just be able to do regular life, you know. I just didn't think it was me. I thought I was too far gone, and I really thought that any opportunity for me to stop drinking, I gave up trying to quit drinking a long time before that happened for me. So I don't know. What a sobriety countdown. This is my first time doing this. I just, is from being up here looking at it, the energy is, it's electric. And I tell you, if you're newer, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to a power greater than yourself. And if you're in here, I hope you're desperate. That's what I was sitting here thinking, looking at you all, standing up, that if you're new to AA and you've ever decided to stop drinking and you seem that you can't follow through with that decision, then you're here tonight. I hope you're desperate. I hope you're desperate enough to ask somebody for help, that we have a way out of the cycle of alcoholism. We have a way out of that, and I'd say it started when I asked for help. I hope you're desperate enough to ask for help. What we're serving here is not a very tasty meal. The book even describes it as being unpalatable. But if you're hungry and desperate, you'll eat it. And it's ego and pride and everything that blocks me off from God and you people. We have a way out to figure all that out. And we want to show you. I want to show you. I'm here in Des Moines. I want to help. Most certainly, we want to help you. So I moved here from Wisconsin, and I wasn't raised in Wisconsin. I got sober in Kentucky. And somebody here from Kentucky? From it was a real small town that I was raised in, and a real small town that I was raised in. And my mother and father had divorced before I could ever remember them living together. And me and my sister lived with my mother. And my father would come pick us up on the weekends. And he would set us down from time to time. I tell you, going and all y'all that spoke on panels today, y'all did a great job. I was in this 10, 11, and 12 panel earlier today. And I tell you, I've gotten a new sponsor here recently. And I tell you, I was really under the pressure for a long time in AA that we don't diagnose people or qualify people. But I mean, knowing that now, the way that I was sponsored, that I need to be sure that you're alcoholic before I work with you. It's just important for you and important for our fellowship that we make sure that you have this thing before we come in and try to help you. So, I mean, just knowing that tidbit now, I used to look back on my childhood and I would think to myself, man, I hope that my parents were alcoholic. I hope that my mother and my stepfather were alcoholics. They just wasn't hard drinkers. Maybe they have an excuse for some of the stuff that I had seen growing up. And knowing what I know now, I could probably definitely say that they were alcoholic. So, and my father, he knew what we was exposed to, and he'd set us down from time to time. He'd say, Seth, he said, you're getting old enough now where I could go hire a lawyer and we could get a court date set and you could tell the judge you want to live with me and then I wouldn't have to worry about you no more. Will you please come live with me? And I'd say, I love my father, but I love my mother too, and I hated when he'd ask me that because I'd tell him no. You know, I felt like I really let him down, and it was just always awkward, and I, you know, you don't want to let your parents down. But he set me down, me and my sister down again one time. It was December 98. He said, Seth, he said, I've been to the doctor, and they tell me I got cancer, and I'm going to be sick for a little bit, but I'm going to get better, so I don't want you to worry. And I said, okay. And I was able to spend that Christmas with him. And then a few weeks went by that he didn't come and pick us up. And it was in February. My older cousin come and picked me and my sister up and drove us to Lawrenceburg to see our father. And I'm sitting on his couch waiting for him to get home from a doctor's visit. And in comes my grandmother, and in comes my stepmother, and then someone walks in that I don't recognize. It was an old man that I had never seen before, and they tell me, they said, Seth, that's your father. And he had the cancer spread really quick and took chemo really bad, and I was able to get off the couch and give him a hug, and then I took off and ran down into our basement, and I got on my knees, and I folded my hands, and I prayed for God not to let my father die. I said, God, if you'll save him, I'll do anything. And I tell you, after my father died, I can't remember saying an honest prayer until alcohol beat me into a state of submission. I was completely godless. And there was plenty of people in my life who pitched me a spiritual solution to what I was suffering from. And especially my grandmother, the most important person in my life, she would sit me down from time to time, and she would say, Seth, if you'd pray for God to take this from you, he would. And I'd look at her right in the eye, and I'd say, don't talk to me about God. I'd tell you, I wanted to hear nothing about that. And I'd tell you, knowing what I know now about my grandmother, there was, out of all the bad stuff that I had done to her, there was nothing I could have said more hurtful. There was nothing I could have said to cause more pain to her than that. And I'd tell you, if I could take back anything, I'd take back that. My father dies. Shortly after that, my mother finally gets a divorce from that abusive stepfather, and she's on the dating scene, and she is doing what she does. She's an alcoholic, and she meets a guy that everybody seems to really like, and he seemed like he was a really nice guy, but some things happened between me and him where my mother was put in a position she had to choose, him or me, and she chose him. And after the litigation took place and all the dust settled, custody was awarded to my father's mother, my grandmother. And I didn't speak to my mother again until I got on my ninth step in Alcoholics Anonymous 12 years later. And I hated my mother. I hated her. Had she had died in that time, I would not have, you know, I wouldn't even went to her funeral. And I was a real trouble kid. I tell you, I always had people like a therapist or a counselor trying to talk to me. And, you know, I would tell them all that there's no way that I'm behaving because of what happened to me or because of my mother, because she means absolutely, I was indifferent. She meant absolutely nothing to me. How can what I'm doing or how I'm behaving have anything to do with her at all? Let's move on to the next subject. And that's how I treated it. So coming into AA, working through that stuff, it was, I tell you, I'm going to get to it. It's been a hard path for me. I've made it a lot harder than I had to have. So with me living with my grandmother. I tell you, there was some hoops she had to jump through. I tell you, I was 13 when I moved in there. I was a bad kid. I was a troubled kid already. I tell you, I had done got caught with a controlled substance when I was in the middle school. I had done been drinking and doing what I wanted to do for a long time. It was acceptable. My mother, I would drink with my mother. You know, that's just the kind of house that I was brought up in. It was okay to do that. And so I got caught with this controlled substance. I was hooked up with the Department of Juvenile Justice, and I had to meet with the probation officer once a week, and I had to take random urine screens, and I had to meet with counselors. I had to jump through all these hoops. I had to do whatever they told me to do, and she found all that out, and she said, Seth, we'll take care of it. And what she didn't know and what it took a long time for me to understand was that I'm allergic to alcohol. You know, and no matter what the consequence of sitting in front of me, I'm going to drink. And if you're a kid, a juvenile in that position, faced with that, one thing's going to happen to you, and that happened to me, is that I spent the majority of my adolescent life in detention centers and group homes and boot camps or treatment centers, people where they literally managed my life for me. And I tell you, there was early on in that process, you know, after I was doing like, you know, like my first 4-day stay, like or a 6-month stay, early on in that process, I would tell myself that when I get out, I'm not going to drink. That all I have to do is put together a 6 months of good behavior, go to school every day, pass these drug tests, and do what they tell me to do. That I can be off this probation and I can do what I want to do. I can be a normal kid, and I make my mind up to do that. And I tell myself I'm not drinking when I get out, and I'd get out, and I'd be drinking. And I had no satisfactory explanation for myself. It seemed like I had just changed my mind. So I tell you what happened is that finally the state, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, stepped in and took custody for my grandmother. And in the brief moments that I wasn't in their care in a facility, I would stay at my grandmother's house. And so I tell you, finally the day come, I turned 18. I've been waiting on this day for a long time because I had been telling myself that as soon as you stop telling me what to do, and as soon as you stop making me pee in this cup, and as soon as I'm able to move out of this house and get a job, make my own money, I'm going to be just fine. I've been telling myself that for a long time. I had convinced myself of it. And my grandmother, being the saint that she is, I had drawn a Social Security check for my father had passed. And I've been thinking about this lately, too. She drawed less money than I did on Social Security. She drawed like $750-$800 a month, Social Security. And she took my whole check and she put it into a savings account and wanted to give me the best head start possible in life and fed me and my family on her money and paid the bills with her money. And but there it was. I turned 18. I had a little over $20,000 in my pocket, you know, that my grandmother just trying to do the best she could. All she knew how to love me. And I'm here to tell you what I said in the beginning. I meant it just by God's grace that I made it. There's a lot of people that I was running with around that time that just ain't here today. So, and I don't know why that is. It's just the way that it happened. But I blew through that money in no time and never even moved out. And I tell you, it was a real odd time in my life because I tell you, I was about 18 and a half, somewhere around there, and I hadn't been locked up in about 5 or 6 months. I can't remember. I knew this, that I was real tired. I was real tired. I was so tired that I called my uncle up and said, you know what, this is what I'm doing, and I'd like to come and live with you for a little bit so I can dry out. I said, can I come and stay with you for a little bit? And he said, hell no, you can't come stay with me. And what they did, at that time, my family kind of corralled together. They saw some sort of spark of willingness inside them, and they all come together, and they found a homeless shelter in Lexington that also had a treatment center attached to it, and they took me there, and they dropped me off, and I stayed my 5 days in detox in that homeless shelter. But when it come time to lay my mat on the floor with the homeless people in Lexington, I was unwilling. And the truth is, while I was in there in that 5 days, my brain hurt a little bit, and I thought, you know what? I called someone else, and they let me come stay with them for a little bit, which was my dad's youngest brother. And I tell you, what that started my life was living with my dad's youngest brother was a nasty, vicious cycle of people seeing good in me and people wanting to help me and sacrificing for me and trying to do right by me and me starting off in their home with this firm desire to do something different. you know what, you know, with this willingness to try to stop. And I wouldn't, I would be in there and something would happen. I'd make it for a few days maybe, and then the unhappy day would come where I would, where I'd steal what they had and I'd be gone. So, I tell you, I didn't stop going to jail when I turned 18. You know, it did not take long to get acquainted with the county jail where I was from. I was always in and out. And looking back on it now, knowing what I know now, that it saved me, you know. But there was this one time I had wrote all these cold checks in like three different counties, and they let me out for a chance to pay them, but I didn't pay them, so they picked me back up, and I spent 9 months in our county jail for these cold checks. And my grandmother and my cousin come and pick me up from the jail, and when I got back to the house, my aunt and my uncle was there, and I thought this was really odd. Because it had been a long time since people were coming to welcome me, like there was a welcoming home party. I knew that something was up. And I walk in there, and I go back in my bedroom. Had been my bedroom since I was 13. It wasn't my bedroom anymore. They had packed everything I owned and put it into garbage bags and set it in the closet. And I come back, and they're sitting around the table. They said, "We want to talk to you." They said, "Seth, we're not going to allow you to live here no more and watch you kill yourself. And we're not going to stand by and watch you steal off our mother and do nothing about it. And what we're planning to do, what we've made arrangements for you to do, is to go to Sayersville to live with your great aunt and your great uncle. And we want to take you there right now if you want to go." And at that moment in my life, it was there at the bridge. And I said, "I'll go to Sayersville." And I'm back in my room, and I'm going through this bag, trying to get a bag to take to Sayersville with me so I have some clothes to wear. And in my bedroom, my grandmother comes in there. She's got her hands folded like this, and she says, "Seth," she said, "I had nothing to do with this." She said this was their idea, and told me I was always welcome there and that she loved me. She said, "But this is, you know, this is a good thing for you. This would be good for you to get out of Powell County for a little bit. You don't know nobody in Sayersville. This could be a new start for you." And I said, "You know what, you're right." And then she handed me a $50 bill, and she said, "Seth, this will get you some cigarettes until you're able to get on your feet and get a job." And I took it, and I thanked her and gave her a hug. And when she exited my room, the book in the doctor's opinion talks about this mental obsession that I suffer from. I tell you, man, she gave me that money. I tell you, I needed a drink. I needed a drink real bad. 9 months without nothing, no solution inside of me. The feelings that welled up inside of me required alcohol. And now that I had the money, what I did is I shut the door and I locked it, and I climbed out my window and I sprinted across town. And it was a mission, as you can imagine, being on a time crunch. I was gone for a few hours, and whenever I got home, I nearly had to fight my uncle. Nearly had to fight him, and then I saw the look on my grandmother's face. She'd been crying, and I used to think it was disgust that she had in her face. I thought that for a long time until recently. I think it's more confusion than anything. What sort of thinking dominates a man who time after time tries a desperate experiment of the first drink? Of what is he thinking? Only an insane person will go back to doing what just got him locked up for 9 months. It confuses the people that love us. And they still put me in the car and took me to Sayersville because they know that she couldn't put me out. And on the hour drive from there to Sayersville, I made my mind up that I was going to stop drinking. That what they told me was true. I don't know anybody in Sayersville. That this could be a new start for me. Matter of fact, I'm putting my foot down. And this time I mean business. This thing's going to be different for me. And I meant it. I never want to see my grandmother look like that again. And I have a family member out there that gives me a job changing tires. And I get my first paycheck and I'm drinking. And it just doesn't look like, you know, I'm starting to lose hope. That great aunt and that great uncle that took me in were sober and Alcoholics Anonymous for over 40 years. And in that first week, they took me to meetings, and they were showing me how to pray, and they was talking to me about the big book. They even had a drunk living with them on the couch already. Really set the bar for me in my life about what we're I'm talking about sacrificing for people. You know, we share our homes, jobs, like we land jobs, we loan money, we do anything for you. If you're trying to stop drinking, you got people here who would do anything for you. That's what I've seen. And I tell you, I started drinking, and then I was taking, they was letting me take the car to meetings, and I was taking the guy with me to meetings, and we would just act like we would go to AA meetings, and I would just drink, which then again, they just landed in one more people that tried to help me, that the unhappy day came with them too, where I robbed them, and I had to go. I tell you, nobody got the blunt of my selfishness more than my grandmother. Nobody. Nobody put up with more. She had been having to hide her purse in her own house for a long time. And then she thought that she couldn't remember how much money she had in her purse. So she was writing it down. And I would hit a lick maybe somewhere else. I have a few extra dollars in my pocket. I would put money into her pocketbook to throw her account off. And I can remember I was walking down the hallway one day, and she had her billfold on her bed, and she has her money. I just counting, and she's crying. And I said, "What's the matter, Graham?" She said, "Seth, I'm going crazy. I can't even count my own money." And I had her right where I wanted her, second-guessing herself, where I'd just take all of it. And I tell you, she had told my aunt. My aunt had told me that she would see me passed out on the couch, and she'd have to put her finger through my nose, make sure I was still breathing, because she thought I was dead. And that's how I treat the most important person in my life, apart from you all and apart from God. That's all I'm capable of. And aside from my grandmother and my family, nobody was safe from me at the end. Just nobody was. This is what I was doing. I was knocking on people's doors in broad daylight. And if they wouldn't answer, I'd force my way in. And I'd take the jewelry and the guns, the kids' video game or the kids' piggy bank, anything I could pawn or get some money from. I had no conception of other people. All that mattered was changing the way that I felt. And that's what I was doing at the end. And on March the 30th of 08, I committed a burglary. And on April the 1st of 08, after leaving the pawn shop, and I'm back at my grandmother's house because she can't ever put me out. You know, there at the end, the last 3 or 4 months, I slept most of the time in my car. But then I still couldn't resist the urge to just go in there. You know, she was never comfortable with me there, but I was there that morning. And walking out of the bathroom from drinking in there. And there's two deputies on the front porch. They want to talk to me. They said, Seth, your Bronco was seen at this house last night that was burglarized. Can you tell us why it was there? I said, I have no idea. I said, my cousin had my car all night last night, and he just brought it back. I said, here's his name and his number. Why don't you go talk to him? And they looked at that fake name, that fake address, and they said, okay, Seth, we're going to go talk to him. But don't go nowhere. We want to come back and talk to you, too. I said, I'll be here all day. I have nothing going on. And as soon as they got down the hill out of the way, I took off. I grabbed the title to my Bronco. I knew where my title was. You know, I grabbed the title to my Bronco, and I sold my Bronco to my friend's father for nothing, just for a few more. And then had to give my best friend at the time, that time I had to give my best friend half of that to get a ride back to Lexington, to that homeless shelter where I could hide out. And then I walked in there on April the 1st, 08. And I took my last shot of alcohol in that detox bathroom. At this point in my life, again, I had given up on the hope that my life could be any different. I could not see life with or without drinking. I had stopped trying to quit, and I wished for the end. And there's no other way to continue this story other than God showed up. It talks about in our stories. I was going to pitch this earlier that in chapter 2, in the second last paragraph in chapter 2, it talks about that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And there's other directions. And I believe if you do that, you do AA a fair job. But it talks about past chapter 2. Furthermore, clear-cut directions are showing how we recovered from alcoholism. And they're followed by 42 personal stories where each writer describes in his own way, from his own point of view, how he developed a relationship with God. I was taught whenever I have an audience, now, yeah, I need to tell people that are powerless over alcohol how I gained access to a power. That's all that's going to help. So this is what happened. I tell you, there's no other way to continue from here on out other than God showed up. A guy that hadn't prayed in years was that I stayed my 5 days in detox. This time when it come to lay my mat on the floor of the homeless people, I didn't even put my sheet on my mat. I used it as a pillow. I just curled up. I didn't feel out of place at all. And I got enrolled into the treatment center program because they take homeless people and people from treatment center. But if you're just in the general population and you're homeless, then they kick you out after breakfast. They let you back in until like 8 o'clock at night. I was pretty tired. I hadn't been locked up in a while. I can remember just being tired. So I got into the treatment center program where I didn't have to trudge the street to Lexington all day. And I had It was April the 9th of 08, and I crossed paths with a gentleman named Michael in the hallway, and I went downstairs to the basement to get into my locker to get my things for the day. And I stayed down there about 20 minutes, and when I come back up, there's three paramedics standing around a guy giving him CPR. And they're beating on his chest, and they're not doing any good. So they put him on the stretch. They put this guy on the stretch, and they pushed a stretcher by me. I see that it was Michael, and his face was blue, and his lips were purple. And he was 27 years old, and he fell dead of a heart attack. And I can remember from where we crossed paths in that hallway, he had about seven steps of life left in him. And I remember the look on his face. He was getting ready for his day just like I was. He had no idea. He had no idea that that was the end. And there was a voice, I used to be ashamed to say that, I don't know more, come from deep down inside of me, this voice asked me if that's what I really wanted, said, do you really want to die? And I tell you, up to that point, I thought that I did until I seen him. I knew that there was no coming back for him, that he had no more chances, that was final. And the best I could come up with, 9 days sober, is I did not want to die anymore. And so what I did from there on out, I started to participate in my own recovery. And if we was in the 10 o'clock class and 3 o'clock class at the treatment center and they was talking about something I didn't understand, I was asking a question. And if I was at an AA meeting of the evening and I had an opportunity to share, I was talking and I was meeting you all. And I tell you, looking back now, I think what helped more than anything was that early on in that program that they just pound the doctor's opinion into my head. And to anybody that comes up, they just do it over and over and over. And I finally, the doctor's theory that I have an allergy to alcohol interests me. Most certainly did when I was young, when I was early in sobriety. But I tell you, to learn that normal people do not crave alcohol, that it just doesn't happen, it's abnormal to crave alcohol once you start to drink. And I thought everybody craved alcohol once they drink. And to think that it's a disease and that I had no control over it, I tell you what that information did was gave me an alibi, is what I used it early on for, is that it finally allowed to take the guilt off my back, to not hate myself so much and not to think that I was such a piece of crap, that I could finally hear what you all were sharing, that I'm different. There's nothing I could have done about it. That's how I used that early on. Saved my life. What I've known now since I've been here is that the allergy and the mental obsession, it explains why I behave the way that I did. It explains it. It doesn't excuse any of it. And that's why we have an amends process. But I tell you, early recovery was very fun for me. It was very exciting for me. I know yours were fun, but it was. I tell you, to be living in a dark place for so long, for the first time ever to have some light at the end of the tunnel was real exciting. I'd say I thought my life was over, and now I'm meeting people all the time that seem to be just like me and that are happy, and I think that maybe this thing can work for me. And nothing other, I'd say it was 30 days sober. They brought a speaker meeting into the treatment center that I was at 3 days a week. It was a Saturday night. This guy got up at a podium, 30 days sober, and this guy, again, saved my life. He was the first guy that had ever convinced me that he drank the way that I drink and was able to stop. Up to that point, I knew plenty of people that was doing stuff that I was doing and how I was doing it. I'd never known of anybody that was able to stop doing that, though. And this guy spoke my language, convinced me, won my confidence, and he was 3 years sober. And I ran up to him right after he got through speaking. I said, man, how'd you quit drinking? How did it work? I didn't catch none of that when he was speaking. I got too caught up on how he was so similar. And he says, Seth, he said, I finally worked all 12 steps. This is what happened for me. I finally started to pray. And because it worked for him, I went back to the base of that homeless shelter where I was sleeping. And I got on my knees and I said, God, if you're real, I need your help. Please, 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 God, if you're real, help me. And then I continued with that. I don't know. You know, I'm finally at this point, I'm calling in and checking in with my family. And you know, whenever I left, I didn't even tell nobody where I was going. But I'm around 90 days sober right now, and I call home to see how my grandmother's doing, and my aunt answers the phone, and she says, Seth, she said, I'm so happy you're doing good. Whatever you do, don't come home. I was looking in the paper today and see you've been indicted, and there's a felony warrant for your arrest. And this is what I had been waiting on the whole time. Even though there was light in the tunnel, I knew the sense of impending doom, that it was just all very fleeting and this was going to come. But what I did is 100 people in the treatment center have become friends with a lot of them. I finally got honest with them. I said, this is how I got here. What should I do? And they said, Seth, go and talk to the people that run this place when they open up in the morning and tell them. And I did, and they pulled it up on their computer and seen that I was a fugitive. And they said, Seth said, I hate to tell you this, but you can't spend the night here. They said, we can't harbor a fugitive. And what I suggest that you do is you go and turn yourself in. And if you can make it back here within 30 days, we'll let you start off in the program where you left at. And I'm looking at this guy like he's got three eyes, because there is no way I'm going to turn myself in. But I thanked him. I went up to my room, and I got these black bags, and I'm packing all my stuff into the bags. And waves of guys start filing into my room asking me what I'm going to do, begging me to go and turn myself in. And it talks about on page 79, that these reparations take innumerable forms, that we may face jail. We must not shrink at anything, having to be reminded that in the beginning we made a commitment to go any lengths for victory over alcohol. There was a guy in that room that I had made that commitment with in that basement 2 months earlier, and he told me, he said, are you gonna back out on that? That guy's still sober. Me and him both are. We got the same sobriety date. And so I call my big sister, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I have some hope that maybe I can stay with her just for a couple of days until I can figure out what I'm going to do. But she picks me up. I put my bags in her car, and I sit down in her front seat. She puts the car in park, and she looks over at me, and she says, Seth, where are you going? I knew that I couldn't stay with her now, so I just knew, I told her, I said, take me to the sheriff's department. And I left straight from treatment, drove straight to the sheriff's department. I walk in there, and I said, I believe you're looking for me. And they said, yeah, we are. And I find out at the sheriff's department that it's a theft over 300 charge. It's not for a burglary. It's for a theft over 300, which is a Class D felony. And it was for stealing some guy's scrap gutters out of his front yard a couple days before I committed that burglary. I seen this guy taking down his old gutters and putting new ones up, and they were laying in his front yard for about a day, and I told myself I'm going to get them gutters because it's gas money. It's aluminum. I only got about $15 worth of aluminum out of the gutters. But I needed that, And so I'm not arguing the amount of aluminum, because I know it just any moment I'm going to see those two deputies that I gave that bogus name to, and, I'm going to have a lot bigger problems. So the deputy, he knew me. He walked me across the street to the jail and allowed me to finish my cigarette before I walked in there, and I was shaking like this. Like, what am I doing? And they get me through the first door and the second door, and I'm able to relax a little bit, and he's booking me in, and he said, Seth, where's your money at? And I said, man, I ain't got no money. And he says, I see you trying to help yourself. He said, I want to help you. And he bought me a $10 phone card and put $10 on my books. And then I sat in front of the pretrial officer, had seen me many times. I showed her that letter the Hope Center had given me, stating where I had been the past 90 days, saying they had a bed for me if I was able to go back. And she said, Seth, should I see something different in you? She said, I'm going to show this to the judge and see if I can get your bond lowered. And I just thank her and, nod my head politely, because I know what my truth is, that once I get dressed out and I get put in the back, ain't nobody going to do nothing for me. I have been doing time on my own for a long time. There's no mail, no money, no letters, no visits, except for my grandmother. Depending on where I was, she would come every now and then to see me and put give me $10 or $5. It's a lot of money to her. And I would just thank her for it. But besides that, ain't nobody pulling strings for me on the outside. I said, whatever you do, I appreciate that. They had one of $60,000 full cash bomb because the judge is dramatic over some aluminum. There's just no other way that could happen. But they take me right into the back, and I make my mat on the floor, and I get settled in because I know I'm going to be there for a little bit. And then I remember I got on my knees, and I prayed that night like I had been doing the past 60 days. And They come over the intercom the very next day, and they said, Seth, if you know somebody that can come pay this $40 booking fee and will sign this surety bond, we'll let you go back to the Hope Center. You don't anybody can do that for you. And I took that phone call. That deputy bought me. I called a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that had known me about 90 days. And he took off from work, come and paid that booking fee and signed that surety bond and took me back to the Hope Center. And I can tell you, I'd say from walking out of that jail, me lighting a cigarette after just 24 hours of walking in there, I talk about tangible evidence of a power that doesn't happen to me. You know, that absolutely does not happen to me. And I tell you, I got back to the treatment center and they called me Captain Recovery the rest of the time I was there because I was enthusiastic about some AA and some God. I made sometimes I forget to talk about this, but I made all my court appearances stricken with fear that I was going to run into them deputies and I was going to have a lot more problems than I already did. You know, it's a small town, you know. But nothing ever come of that fake name, that fake address I gave that deputy. I don't know. I used to be, I remember I was 1 or 2 years sober and I was thinking about maybe I had come so long just to go and do this. You know, a burglary, it's a 5 to 10, you know, it's a minimum 5-year sentence. Maximum 10-year sins that, you know, I would worry about that. And I was sitting there thinking about that in a meeting one day, and somebody was reading how it works, and they got to the part that said, there's one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. I stopped worrying about that, and I've made amends. And I tell you, I think it's more important to share it than not share it. You know, that's what we do, that miracles happen every day. It just shows that I was where I was supposed to be at. These past 10 years here with you all doing God's work best I can. And I got back to the Hope Center and I finally graduated. I stayed in there 10 months. And then it come time to leave and get a job. And that distant family, that great aunt and great uncle was in AA, called me up out of the blue, heard that I was doing better and wanted to know if I wanted to go on the road and do fiber optics. And I said, sign me up. And I've been doing that ever since. So I tell you, it was a long road to get from Kentucky to Wisconsin to here, but I tell you, it's been really, really good, you know, for lack of better words. So I guess what I want to talk about now, while I still got a little bit of time, is like the process of like this crooked path that I've led for people. And I tell you, I was leaving treatment, I had got this guy to sponsor me, and he drank, so I didn't need another sponsor, and I didn't have a sponsor until I was about 18 months sober. I was lucky to have made it, but I had this grandiose idea that I was just going to start this sponsorship line, and everybody was going to be beneath me, and I was going to be at the very top. And I was going to some other meetings. Somebody asked me to sponsor me. The next day, 4 other people asked me to sponsor them. It was all in drug court. I didn't even ask them if they had a book. I had all these sponsees, and I didn't even have a book. I was in meetings sharing that my sponsor said, but I didn't even have a sponsor, you know. I tell you, at 18 months sober, I find out that I could do just as much damage in people's lives just like I was drinking. Be a home wrecker, you know. And, you know, affecting people's lives just as badly, being completely sober. And I realized that either I was going to do what I was sharing or I was going to drink. I got scared. And I asked the guy to sponsor me. We started through the book. And things were going real well for me for a long time. But at 3 years sober, I tell you, I was looking around. And I guess what happened for me was that there was a girl. And I really liked her a whole lot. And she seemed like she was real nice. There's only one big problem, that she liked me too. And it was just never going to work, you know. And what I did at that time, I just stopped talking to her. And I just ghosted her. And I was looking around, and I'd seen that I wasn't close with anybody. There wasn't one person in my life that was not easily replaceable. There was just nobody that meant a lot to me. You know, there's only one person, that was my grandmother, and it was proved to me again and again that she would never leave me, that she'd never stop loving me. She was the only one. Besides that, everybody else could easily go, and I could fill them with somebody else the next day, and I'd be just fine. I was sick of being alone at 3 years sober, and I went to my sponsor, and I told him what I was going through, and he looked at me, and he said, Seth, when are you going to go make amends to your mother? When are you going to stop dodging that? And I said, I was in enough pain then that I said, I'll do whatever you want me to do. And I pulled out that inventory, and I can remember doing that inventory, and I had had her name there, and what had happened and how I was affected, and I was looking for my part, and I had, you know, I did, being a kid, it's hard to find your part and stuff like that. But what I had come up with right then was that, you know, I used to steal her cigarettes, you know, and I was a bad kid already. I was pretty selfish, and I found my sister, and I got a hold of my mother through her and set up a time for me to go over on a Saturday evening to make this amends to her. And my sponsor come with me because he thought it would be a good idea that he'd be there. And I'm sitting down in her living room with her, and I have a chance to share with her what I had found out. And in her big book, it talks about in 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens when we go to these people, we admit our faults, that years of controversy wiped away in a matter of hours. And what I read when I read that, and what I heard when my sponsor told me that was that it happens 10 out of 10 times. You know, I was unprepared to have my mother look at me and say, you know, I forgive you. You know, and not in these words, but what I heard was that I'm so glad you came around. I'm so glad that you found out that you're the problem. And yes, I do have some things for you to do. If you do them, I want you to call me once a week. And I want you to tell me about your life, and I want you to love me. And I tell you, I'm glad my sponsor was there. I was pretty hurt, but because I didn't bring up anything that had been done to me. It was pretty good on that. I don't bring up nothing that was done to me. And I tell her, I said, I'll do all that. I'll do all that, and got her phone number. And as I was leaving, my sponsor seen I was pretty upset, and I go to put the car in drive, and he tells me to hold up. He says, hold up, so I want to talk to you. He puts his hand on my leg, and he tells me, he says, Seth, he said, I want to let you know there's no other place in the whole world that I'd rather be than with you in that living room once you become a man. He said, and I love you. And I tell you, there was to be intuitively inspired, letting know that he loved me and be able to accept that and know that it seemed like I just had to. I was so broken that I had to believe it, you know, and I know that he loved me, and I loved him. And I was glad that he was there with me. And from that first relationship outside of my grandmother has spawned relationships with members of AA and outside AA that mean the absolute world to me, that I would be totally devastated if I woke up tomorrow and you wasn't here. A lot of men and women that mean a lot to me. And it started with my sponsor, for him being there for me. So I tell you, my grandmother, I tell you, it was real hard. She got diagnosed with Alzheimer's, leaving treatment. And I moved out, and I would go and visit her. I'd go and visit her pretty regularly. And I tell you, I squandered a lot of time with her that could have been better because I thought that I wrote her off for dead already because she couldn't remember my name. You know, I tell you, I would go over to her house, and I was still getting mail there, and I was probably 3 years sober, and I'd have some mail on the table, and she'd pick it up, and she'd look at it, and she'd say, Seth. And she didn't know who I was. And I said, I said, that's me, Graham. And she said, I knew that. And then I could put her in my truck. There was a CD that I had found at the house, and it was Alan Jackson singing all these old church hymns. And I could put that CD in that truck and drive through this state park that she'd enjoyed just a few miles from the house. And I put that CD, and she'd not know who I was, but she could sing every word to every song. And, to be able to be present for that, to be able to break up the monotony of her day and let her know that there's people that care about her, and there's nothing that I'd rather be doing than that. I tell you, to be, I owe a huge debt to Alcoholics Anonymous for that, you know. And here I am in my pity at that time thinking, oh, she's already gone. You know, she lived 6 more years. And so, those were really good times. I couldn't enjoy him at the moment, though, because I was too worried about what was going to happen. And because it got bad with her. And it got bad. I moved away. It was just what needed to happen. I moved away and got a job in Wisconsin, and left my aunt, who wanted to. She just gave up her life to take care of her mother, you know, for almost 5 years. Just gave it up. And I'm back in. I moved to Eau Claire, and I tell you, the move was a little difficult for me too. But I tell you, because I was told to get a new sponsor whenever I moved, that I needed to have a guy that I could meet face to face. And I tell you, I did not foresee that being such a huge hurdle for me. I tell you, I would just go up there, I'd just get a sponsor, no problem. I had never been sober anywhere other than Kentucky, and I tell you, it was a big hurdle for me. I tell you, I judged everybody. Nobody was doing the AA right in Wisconsin. I was surprised they even got sober. And there was nobody nearly spiritual enough to sponsor me. But I finally asked the guy to help me. And we went through the work, and, you know, it fizzled out, and I stopped talking to him. And I was up in Eau Claire, and I hadn't talked to a sponsor in about 8 months. And then I get a call from my aunt, and they said, Seth, hospice just told us that it's probably going to be within the week when your grandmother dies. This is last March. And so it's a Sunday night. I put my bags, I pack a bag, and I get in the car, and I start driving to Kentucky to be with my grandmother. And I get a call going through Indiana, and my sister calls me. We don't have the same grandmother. It's on my mother's side. And she calls to tell me that my mother's had a heart attack, and she's on life support at the hospital in Lexington. She just thought that I should know. And I said, okay. And I tell her that I'm on my way to Kentucky and tell her about my grandmother. And had she called me and had my grandmother been sick, I wouldn't even went to Kentucky to see my mother, you know. After making that amends at 3 years sober, I did my very best to be a good son. I mean, for 4 years in a row, I showed up every Thanksgiving with a pie in my hand at her house. And every Christmas, I showed up with a gift in my hand. I was never able to be in her presence and exhale. You know, it was still right there with me. And I got that call in Indiana on the way down there. I was thinking I wouldn't even have went down there to see her in the hospital, and still had no plans of seeing her in the hospital when I got to Kentucky. I had bigger things on my plate than her. But what happened, they're visiting my grandmother. My sister's car breaks down and needs a ride from Clay City to Lexington to the hospital so she can see her mother. And asked me for a ride, and I said, I'll give you a ride. And I gave her a ride 5 days in a row to the hospital, and I pull her up right at the front, and she says, Seth, you want to come in? I said, no, I don't want to come in. I don't want to see her up there. And I never went up there and seen her. My mother, she survived, but I didn't think she was going to. Nobody did. And then my grandmother dies, and I tell you, I'm back in Wisconsin now, and I hadn't spoken to a sponsor in 8 months. And the most important person in my life just dies. And I hate myself for not being able to forgive my mother. I feel like a fraud in AA. And on top of all that is that I'm mad at God for the way my grandmother suffered. I thought that she deserved better. So I'm just in a real bad spot. I can't even pray. And I tell you, so I know I'm in a bad spot, and I got this guy's number that had been wanting them to sponsor me for a while. He's actually out of Cedar Rapids. And I call this guy up, and I tell him, I said, will you help me? He said, yeah. He said, I'll help you. And we start going through the work about 14 months ago. And I tell you, I got a new experience now. It's what happened for me. We went through the work. We started reading, and when we got to the inventory process, I tell you, I had missed something. I had missed the boat for a long time with this, and probably people had told me, and I had probably heard it in meetings, but I was never able to digest it. And when it talks about doing this resentment inventory, you know, we got who it is and what happened and how it affected me, and I'd always heard we're looking for our part, and I talked about that earlier, and it That verbiage, I think, really messed me up for a long time. And it doesn't say that we look for our part. It talks about putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done to us. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, afraid? Where was I to blame? And I was in enough pain at that time to look at this from an entirely different angle like it asks us to. And to help and to pray to help me see her with the same pity, tolerance, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And I tell you, I don't know. I was able to see something when I asked for God's help and to see her white as snow, completely innocent, like a child of God. And when I was able to turn the page to do this fourth column, when I was able to ask myself those questions, putting out of my mind everything that had done wrong to me, the first thing was very apparent. It was very clear to me that she's alcoholic, you know. And the second thought that came to me was that she's never been 12-step. And furthermore, that the only member of Alcoholics Anonymous that she knows is me. Somebody that last time I seen her, I wouldn't even let her hug me. 6 years sober, 5 years sober, something like that. And I don't know. And, you know, some other stuff come up. That stuff happened 18 years ago. That was one night 18 years ago. She could have been in a blackout for all I know, you know. I don't know because we never talked about it. When I get to my A step, the first person on my list is my mother, and I talk to my sponsor, and he says, what do you think you should do? I said, I think I need to go and make amends to her face-to-face, and it takes 10 days to get a hold of my mother. Alcoholism, she's in advanced stages of that now, and so it takes 10 days to get a hold of her. I set up a dinner with her and my sisters and all their kids. It was the first time we'd ever been out to dinner, me and my two sisters and their kids. I take them out to the Golden Corral, and they get dressed up with you know, and I'm thinking about what I want to say all the way down there, and I have it all in my head how I want to lay it out. And it looks like I'm going to punk out. It looks like I'm going to let fear overtake me. I don't want to do it, you know. And but it comes around like God shows up, like the ride doesn't pick my sister and my mother up, and I said, I'll give you a ride. And my sister's in the passenger seat. My mother's in the back. She's got one leg out the car. And I turn around and I tell her what was the only truth that I had at that time, that I was sorry. That I was sorry for how our relationship turned out and how I wish things could have been different. And she just starts crying. And she said, I'm sorry for anything that you think that I've done to you. And at the end of her life, you know, she's still living right now. She may live forever, but if she was telling me she only had 6 months to live, you know, so facing that, still not being able to own up to anything. And my sister, I get her out of the car. She says she wants a hug, so I get out of the car and I give her a hug. And I take my sister back to her house, and she says, Seth, she says, I'm so glad she wasn't drunk. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, she'd been drinking. She was under the influence. She said, Seth, you don't understand. That by this time of the night, most of the time, she's incoherent. She can't get around. You know, she said, she really tried for you. And to summarize, that meant a lot to me. You know, she went to that effort and made an impression on me. And I'm driving back to Wisconsin the next day. And I'm thinking that after, like on the way down there, I'm thinking I'm just going to float back to Wisconsin. I'm going to have this spiritual upheaval. Like once I finally lay this to bed, like what's going to come of me now, you know? And I don't feel any different driving back to Wisconsin. I'm wondering if I even did it right, you know? And then I have a thought that comes to me when I wake up, an honest thought that comes to me and says, Seth, I hope that she feels better. Hope that when she woke up today that she knows she had a son that cared about her enough to go down there and do that to her, to tell her that. I hope she feels better. And finally, I was able to connect the dots of what had been shared with me in AA meetings for a long time. The men's process isn't about me feeling better. It's about them feeling better, about cleaning up my past, my wreck. And when I was able to answer that successfully, that I do hope that she feels better, and I hope she's in a good spot right now. Our relationship looks like nothing like I thought it would, with me not resenting her anymore. Me wishing the best for her. She's still drinking, you know. She still doesn't have a phone to call. You know, I don't know where she is right now. And that's just where her life's taken her. So, I tell you, it's been a long road to get here, like I said. And, like, finally putting that to bed, it's put me in a position to move to Des Moines, you know. Never thought this would happen for me. I feel like I'm forgetting something. I just got more time than I normally do. I got a whole hour. So, I tell you, while I'm up here, I guess I'm just going to... I'm going to end with a story. I really don't like stories. I'm not big on theatrics from the podium, but I heard this story when I was newly sober, and it stuck with me, and sometimes I'll share it. So I'll share it with you. I hope you all enjoy it, and after that, I'll just end. This is a story. Some of y'all that's been around for a while probably have heard it, and I'm sorry you're going to have to sit through it again, but it's okay. And it's a story that goes around in Kentucky. It's called this. It's about the man who wanted to be sober more than anything. And so there was this guy, he wanted to quit drinking. He had tried to quit drinking on his own, but he couldn't pull it off. And he tried everything he could on his own. And someone finally asked him and told him, said, you should probably ask, you know, you could ask God for help to stop drinking. He said, well, I've tried everything else, I'll do it. And he said, God, will you help me stop drinking? And a miracle happened. God answered him. He said, yeah. He said, I can help you stop drinking. But what can you do for me? What are you going to give me? And the guy looked at God, and he said, I don't know, what do you, you know, I don't have nothing, what do you want? And God said, shook his head, and he said, well, how much money do you got? And the guy reached into his pocket, he said, I got $40. And God said, that's not a whole lot, but that'll do. He said, I'll take it. And the guy looked at God, said, you want my $40? He said, yeah, if you want me to help you quit drinking, I'm going to need that. He said, but God, if I give you my $40, how am I going to put gas in my car? And God said, you got a car. You got a car. And he said, yeah. He said, well, if you want me to help you get sober, I'm going to need your car too. He looked at God and said, God, if you take my car, how am I going to get to my job? God said, you got a job too. He said, I'm going to need your job too if you want me to help you stop drinking. And the guy's just getting madder at God. And God, the guy says, God, if you take my job, how am I going to pay the mortgage on my house? And God said, you got a house. I'm gonna need your house too if you want me to help you to stop drinking. The guy looks at God and he says, God, if you take my house, where's my wife and kids gonna live? And God said, you still got your wife and kids. God said, if you want me to help you to stop drinking, I'm gonna need them too. And the guy looks at God and says, God, if you take my wife and kids, I won't have the will to live. I won't have a life. And God said, that's what I want. Your will and your life. And the guy thought about it for a little bit, and he just knew that it would all be gone soon if he didn't stop drinking. And he said, God, take it. Just don't let me drink. And the guy says, okay, now you're sober. He said, what I want you to do is I want you to go and tell people who can't quit drinking what I want. Tell them they don't need to give all that you gave. Tell them their will and their lives, all I need. He said, and while you're doing that work for me, I'm going to give you your money back. I'm going to give you your car back. I'm going to give you your job back. Here's your house, and here's your wife and kids. But don't ever forget, that ain't your money. That ain't your house. That ain't your wife and kids. That ain't your car. That ain't your job. They're mine, and I'm letting you borrow them. And if you remember that, you'll be just fine. I tell you, all God's wanted from me is my will and my life. I tell you, y'all taught me how to do that through the 12 steps. Thank y'all for my life. That's all I got.